council.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In 1992, the commission issued a certificate to Williston Basin to provide contract service to Northern States Power Company for an alternate source of supply for a portion of Northern States system. And it specifically certificated this service to be provided under the non-open access provisions of its regulations, Part 157, as opposed to Part 284, which is the open access section. This case and the orders that the commission issued in it are the first time that the commission, and it's the only time, that the commission has abrogated a contract and required the pipeline to cease providing service under the original certificate and to start providing service under an open access certificate for the customer. The commission has had numerous orders since it first said there would be a distinction between 157 and 284 contracts, in which it has consistently held that it would not require conversion. But what is
the implication of all those decisions is that had it made other findings of fact, it not only could have but might have. Is that the implication of those decisions?
Yes, and we don't argue that they don't have the authority to do it. What we're arguing is that they didn't do it properly. And what we're arguing is that if you're going to, especially in light of all the history of these orders time after time after time saying no, that you have to be held to a higher standard than just saying, well, we've changed our minds.
So that's,
I don't know if they even said they changed their minds.
Yeah, standard.
But go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, but they have. They changed their minds because they first said this contract's okay. They certificated it. They said you, Williston Basin, may provide this service this way.
They said they changed their minds in that sense, but
yes.
They didn't say, here we are on the basis of X. We conclude that our policy was mistaken. I thought that was one of your points.
It is. No, that they do not do that. Yes, that is my point. Exactly is my point. They do not. They don't, to cut to where we are here about this is they try and say that their decision is supported by substantial evidence and it's just and reasonable to abrogate this contract. But they don't point to any evidence in the record. The commission.
On that, but just they do point to the testimony of Hultz, I think it is.
Yes.
With respect to the greater competition that would probably follow with NSP controlling the capacity that it doesn't use, right?
Yes.
And although it's not exactly a extensive competitive analysis, intuitively, that seems correct.
Yes, right? But...
I understood your argument to be that was a given back from the days that they preserved Part 157 certificates without imposing open access on them, and therefore standing alone doesn't change the matter unless they make a change of policy.
Well, exactly. Plus, it's also when in Order 636 and the orders that followed it, the commission specifically said that 157 customers were not going to get the benefits of open access like capacity release, and this court approved that holding of the commission in the United Distribution Company's case that reviewed Order 636. So we're not in a situation where this just was a bolt from the blue. This is a long-standing history, and the services are very different.
But the long-standing history in this case, is it not, is that the party started out with 157, and then the commission came out with 636B, and then NSP made these requests, and the parties couldn't reach agreement. And they repeatedly made these requests. And then finally, initially the commission said, well, that's not the forum. And then when your client filed the Section 4 filing, the commission said, well, this is the time, this is the proper forum to take up NSP's request. I mean, that's a long history for the commission to look at in terms of its preferences and its concern about the impact on competition.
Yes, but why is this the only contract that there's this concern about? There are other pipelines have these.
Obviously, there are other concerns out there, as these other cases indicate. But apparently, the parties either resolved matters or did what the commission hoped they would do.
Yes, but just because the commission hoped it, they said conversion was voluntary. And they also said, you know, you're...
Under any and all circumstances? That's your argument, isn't it?
Yes. Well, yes, except our argument also is that if they can find that it is no longer in the public interest for this contract to be a Part 157 contract, they have the legal authority to do that. But they have to have evidence that shows it. They can't just have one sentence statement by a witness that says, well, there'll be competition. They didn't
so
look at the market.
I understand that argument, but on the other hand, the commission says, well, we read the Memphis Clause as a very broad clause here. Both sides had the chance to essentially change aspects of the contract.
Yes, they do say that. But there's a big difference between changing a term or condition of service and changing the service itself.
But the commission's basic response to that is it's the same service that your client is going to.
But it's not.
You're relying on ExxonMobil, ExxonMobil for that?
Yes.
That didn't convince me, I must say, because it looked to me as if there was an actual extension of the the area covered or the line covered in ExxonMobil, unless I'm misreading it.
No, ExxonMobil was the...
Well, this looks like a change in terms of service.
Right. The court said in ExxonMobil that the commission could not require a distributor to accept additional service.
Right.
And so it was not about the pipeline, it was about the customer. But if the one is true, then the opposite should also be true, that the pipeline should not be required to provide additional service without substantial evidence of record.
Yeah. I mean, there appears to be a distinction between additional service and different terms of service. And I guess on its face, this looks like a different term of service rather than additional service.
No, it's additional service because now they release capacity on the mainline part of the system for which they don't pay, and other people can take and do take that capacity and use it to take it to delivery points that are not on the Maple 10 extension.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you're getting into something that I do want enlightenment on, and that is the talk about the original certification of the Mapleton extension, but the contract, evidently, the initial contract, gives NSP rights beyond the Mapleton extension, no?
It gives them the right to have receipt points for their gas on other parts of the system because there are no sources of gas on the Mapleton extension. So they, in order to get service, the gas had to come from someplace farther up the line. But the costs that they pay for are solely related to the cost of the facilities that were added to provide them service. Because we built this line 50 miles off our system.
In any event, it did entitle NSP to have the benefits of gas moving on the main lines, the lines other than the Mapleton extension. Is that
yes, or otherwise there would have been no gas moving.
Right, that's what I thought. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, right,
yes.
Right. So, and that's why there's this confusion about the benefits to NSP from being able to resell capacity versus the difference in price with respect to the Mapleton extension.
Yes.
Which seems to bedevil
Yes, but now with open access, they have the right to release their capacity to other shippers who use different parts of the system from Mapleton.
Right, right.
And that's one of the reasons we believe that it is additional service. And now they do have the right to change receipt and delivery points, which they could not automatically do before. And they have the right to segment their capacity, which they couldn't do before. So that's why it's our position that this fundamentally is a different service, and it is a bigger service than they had.
Suppose you lose on that. It seems to me your position still is that the commission has, in effect, pointed to nothing other than circumstances which would have been true universally at the original, in 1992, I guess, the
yes.
key time, plus Williston's refusal to back down, which the relevance of which is obscure to me.
Well, you know, first of all, what Judge Rogers said was correct in the history, but there were years between when the commission did 636B and NSP first asked to change the contract. And we put in evidence in the record that said that the original deal with the parties was that when NSP was not using its capacity, it was to be available to Williston Basin to sell, and that there were to be no costs incurred by our customers as a result of making this deal with NSP. You know, one of the things that you need to remember is NSP wasn't connected to our system. We had never had any dealings with them. They weren't a customer of the company. So this line was built at their request because they needed a source of supply at that time in North Dakota, because the North Dakota Commission told them that they needed to get one. And so that's why the deal from the beginning was, all right, we'll build this, but it can't cost our customers any money, because if it's going to, we're not going to do it. And that is a big difference between that and if they had been a customer of ours and therefore were entitled to different rights and responsibilities than they otherwise would have had.
Can we go back to the things that the commission points to in paragraph 45 of the order on rehearing? There's the competition element, which we've talked about. Then there is the Williston making an aggressive interpretation of its rate position,
right.
The relevance of which is obscure. And then there's Williston not agreeing to this. Now, I guess, as it seemed to me, if the proposition is that normally we won't force a pipeline to accept essentially open access, that nothing has happened to make this abnormal in the sense that the pipeline, by the commission's account, has stood on its rights.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. And our aggressive interpretation was we went to the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit, by 2-1 decision, said that the commission was right and we were wrong. But we had one judge who said we were right. So that's aggressive, but it's not insane.
I don't know, even if you'd lost 3-0, I don't know if it would be really pertinent.
But that's the aggression. It's the commission wrote the order, I think it's fair to say, it's relatively intemperate language that they're using, because they're mad because they wanted us to say yes. But that's different from, did we do anything we shouldn't have done? And you have the finding by the ALJ in the order that the commission cites that finds that we were providing the exact service that we had been certificated to provide. No more, no less. Under the conditions that the commission ordered.
I didn't notice that. Focus on it anyway.
So it's on
the ALJ.
Yes, it's on page 165 of the joint appendix, where the commission cites to the judge's finding that we were providing the service that had been certificated. Unless I got it wrong. Paragraph 40. She acknowledged that Williston itself is not alleged to be utilizing its capacity in a manner that is inconsistent with the existing regulatory scheme. We were doing exactly what the commission had certificated us to do. And so, yeah, we have, maybe we're aggressive because we went to court, but we did what we were told to do and what we were required to do contractually. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent?
Good morning. Carol Banta for the commission. With me at council table is Robert White, counsel for Northern States. To begin with Judge Williams' last point about the relevance of Williston's refusal over a number of years to negotiate,
unwillingness to negotiate or unwillingness to accept NSP's proposals?
Well, both, I think, because when the commission remanded this to the ALJ for a hearing, it also hoped that there would be some possibility of settlement.
So we know that there wasn't a settlement.
Right.
That's okay. All we know, right.
I don't know if it, I may have misspoken.
I'm not sure that intransigence, if there was any, is relevant to a judgment like this, but I don't see a record of intransigence except in the sense of
What the commission said.
Sticking by what they saw as their rights.
Right, but the commission said that we've been saying very clearly since Order 636, we strongly favor this, we strongly encourage it. We're not going to impose it on everyone uniformly because there are specific circumstances, and we really hope you'll do this voluntarily. And many shippers have. And then in the later orders that the commission cited, if it isn't done voluntarily, we have the authority as petitioner concedes.
The commission's authority is not in dispute.
Right, but we have the authority, and we will use it in appropriate circumstances if you
That's
don't.
Why I saw right. paragraph 45 as the commission's effort to respond to Williston's challenge in its request for rehearing. Mm-hmm. What are the appropriate conditions? So I looked pretty carefully at paragraph 45.
That is certainly one place where.
What do you see as the top item there?
I think it's the impairment of market health. Well, there are a couple aspects.
So how is the impairment of market health different from what was inherent in the situation from day one?
Well, with regard to this specific
inherent
system,
conditions which prevailed when the commission adopted its policy of not forcing conversion.
Well, looking at the specific circumstances of this pipeline, the secondary market is dominated by the pipeline itself and its largest by a vast majority shipper, which is its own affiliate. That may not be the case on every system. So the commission looked at the potential for a healthy, competitive, efficient market in secondary capacity and said,
I'm not sure how that is so aggravating because if in ordinary Part 157 service, it is the pipeline that controls unused capacity, I'm not sure it makes any difference about the relationship of shippers to the pipeline because in any event, you have the pipeline as the one seller of unused capacity, right? So I'm not sure that in this, at least the commission hasn't explained why the fact that an affiliate is the main shipper alters that.
Because you have, the commission viewed it as having the related players being essentially the whole ballgame as far as any market for secondary capacity or secondary market released or interruptible.
That's going to be the case in any situation where the pipeline retains the exclusive right to sell unused capacity.
Not if it has unaffiliated shippers with secondary rights.
The premise here is that it doesn't run.
No, but the other shippers on the system, the FT shippers, such as Williston Basin, which is the by far the largest, they have the potential, and this was the whole point of 636, to create potential for firm shippers to release their capacity to compete with the pipeline's own interruptible. And in this situation, really the only potential competition with Williston Basin's own interruptible service is its own affiliate's released capacity, and that's what the commission was looking at, is that we don't have, because of this circumstance, there isn't a lot of released capacity that's going to be in competition with the interruptible. So you end up, that's what 636 wanted to create that competition because it drives down the interruptible rates
right,
as well.
Right, I understand that.
Sure. And so in this circumstance, among the facts that the commission found was that the potential for that secondary market to develop when the vast majority of the firm transportation with the potential for lease capacity is the pipeline's own affiliate. And their only competition is their own affiliate. But that was only one of the factors. I mean, the commission also looked at years of rebuffing. I know, but...
I really don't understand that.
Well,
if you say here A and B, and people in the A situation are encouraged but not required to yield certain rights to the B people, and a particular A1 doesn't yield those rights, so what?
Because first of all, when we're talking about standing on its rights, it does bring us back to the Memphis Clause. I mean, the commission did change the terms of the service, and yes, it's not exactly like the X13 contract, and maybe if it were subject to Mobile Sierra, we might have a different discussion. So that comes into it. But in addition, the commission said, what's the reason for not converting? And the ALJ found very early on, and the commission affirmed, that it's not an issue of cost recovery of the Mableton extension because Northern States is actually paying a higher rate than the FT rate under its X13. So
I thought the reason for not agreeing to it was that Williston wanted the return on resale of unused capacity.
Well, that may be, but the commission said
like
that
mainly
given
a dispute over where this 400,000 a year plus or minus goes.
Sure, and I definitely do want to get to that as well. The commission said that under these circumstances, given what it means in terms of developing a competitive secondary market, given that it's not about shifting the cost of the any concerns about shifting the cost of the Mapleton extension to other parties because the incremental rate will be continued. So, and then the commission looked what is the impact on other customers and found that when you took it all together, it was unjust and unreasonable to continue this form of service.
Is the commission's basic view here that these contracts were entered into at about the time of the development of open access? They're a vestige of the old anti-competitive world, that now there is a change. Now we have a competitive world in which releasing this capacity can actually produce actual competition, that where there are justifications for not making those changes,
exactly,
where people are able to make settlements of compromise, we won't interfere.
Or as in Transco, where there are operational reasons why it would be harmful, yes, to other customers. That's exactly what the commission said.
And,
yes,
and where all those conditions don't exist, then we want competition, and now we're going to force it.
Right. Assuming that the proposal going forward is just and reasonable, which was the other part of the commission's analysis, that it was just and reasonable. And the commission repeatedly emphasized that the rate that Northern States will be paying continues to be higher than the FT1 rate and was always contemplated to eventually converge with the
firm rate. I understand that as a general argument. One thing I don't understand is the argument that NSP, by giving NSP the authority to release and therefore to compete, that they'll get a $402,000 benefit on that side, but that the only loss to Williston Basin is $50,000. How is that possible?
Because the ALJ held a full hearing, as the commission sent it to her to do, took testimony, held 3 days of hearing, in this record, the only evidence in this record of the actual impact on the firm rates, the FT1 rate,
yeah,
the only evidence in this record was the $50,000.
The $50,000 is a credit of some kind of the benefits that they were passing on at the time, right?
Right.
So seems to me there's two possibilities. One is the possibility that they're suggesting, which that's just the benefit on the extension, while the $402,000 is overall.
Right.
The other alternative is somehow they weren't passing on that benefit before.
Those are the two possibilities. One is that was, in fact, factored into the FT1 rate. Nothing in this record, and plenty of opportunity to put that in the record. I mean, the commission said it would seem that these that these interruptible revenues never went into the rate. The evidence that presented in this hearing was that in the 1999 FT1 rate case, they accounted for $50,000.
They say that this is because that this $50,000 is just on the extension.
That may be, but it may also be all the on this record.
There's no evidence that that's correct in the record. Is that?
There's no evidence that anything else.
Yes, there's no evidence that there's not additional money.
Exactly. So it is possible, but on this record, who knows? And the commission, I do want to add.
It is the case, isn't it, that the witness who is credited with respect to the $50,000 explicitly purported to address only the Mapleton extension.
But the question had been asked about the 1999 FT1 rate case. And again, if Williston Basin wanted to put more evidence that this was going into its FT rates, it should have and could have done so. On this record, we have no reason to know. But the commission did say on JA 240, I'm sorry, that's not the right page. Page 238, JA 238, says in footnote 58, and again indicates in paragraph 36 of the rehearing order, that even if that $400,000 was going into figuring the FT rate, on balance, the commission still would find this just and reasonable because Northern States has paid for that capacity.
Of the commission, and it's sort of troubling because to say that it paid for it, yes, in a sense, the contract entitled it to use it, but the contract also was entered into under the understanding that if it didn't use it, Williston had the right to resell it. So to say that all you're doing is making the contract conform to the contract.
The commission didn't. The commission said we're making it conform to our policy. And our policy is if you're paying for the reserved capacity, you should be able to use it.
Right. You and the commission resolutely ignore the ambiguity in that. NSP paid for it, in the sense that there's a contract which entitles it to use it, but does not entitle it to resell it.
Well, and the contract just doesn't address it. It's not that there's a provision of the contract that says.
You don't dispute that under the understandings prevailing at the time.
Sure, at the time. And that's exactly the commission's point. And I do want to come back to Judge Garland's point about the $400,000.
Okay.
So I do want to come, but I want to finish with your point first. That the commission also made the point, and I do want to emphasize this, that orders 500 and 636 relied on Section 5 unjust and unreasonable standard as well. And the commission said that was a more fundamental change than what we're talking about here. We took sales contracts and said they have to become open access transportation. Here we're saying that a transportation-only contract has to have different terms and conditions.
I think you're going back to the issue of authority, which is not in dispute.
Well, also that 636 changed the landscape, and it changed the landscape on an unjust and unreasonable finding. And it didn't do it with regard to these particular,
And you weren't going to do it abruptly with respect to each of these at the time, and you'd let it play out and see whether people voluntarily made changes or whether there were conditions under individual circumstances.
That's exactly what the commission was getting at, and that's what it said in 636B. We strongly think these should be converted.
You're saying there's a footnote that says, even if we're wrong on the 402,000 versus 50,000 point, that we would have come out the same way anyway, just on that general principle that competition
is
good.
Yes. Footnote 58 on JA 38, footnote 58 in the rehearing order. And the same idea comes out on the next page in paragraph 36.
That again turns entirely on the proposition that NSP should receive it because it's paying for the capacity.
It does. I mean, that
begs the question.
I want to look at that for a second. I had not understood this, since they are paying for the capacity, to be an argument that they had a contractual right.
It's not.
But rather
it's
general theory that
we're
going to get more competition by allowing reselling.
That's exactly right.
And as long as they are paying reservation rights.
Exactly. And the commission also repeatedly pointed to the fact that the rate here was always intended to eventually converge with the maximum demand rate under FT1, and the reason that this change was reasonable, one of the reasons it's just and reasonable, is that the X13 rate is going to continue to be higher than the FT rate. In other words, the NSP is paying a higher rate than the firm shippers who are getting the full 284 rates.
That's a small amount difference, right?
No, it's not. It's, I was, there are numbers, and I, were those, I think they're in the joint appendix. I hadn't focused on them. It's about 50% more. The delta up above the FT1 rate, by the most recent numbers I've seen, is about 50% more.
But these are going to converge, right?
Eventually, with these biennial restatements. I don't think, I'm not aware of any particular timeline that's been put on it for that to happen.
Leaving aside the percentage, what is the actual amount of money? And how does it compare to this $450,000 that they're getting? $402,000.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I believe it's in the orders, but I don't recall the answer to that. But I did want to go back to the one earlier point you said about the two possibilities for the where the 400,000 goes, and that there's no evidence in this record that it goes into the reducing the FT1 rates, and then the commission said even if. But the other possibility, which is the all the commission finds in this record, but maybe it's a failure of proof, is that Williston Basin retains those profits for the benefit of its shareholders. So it's either going to the pipeline or it's theoretically.
I obviously thought that that was possible too, and I was wondering whether that wasn't solved during the, with respect to the return on investment issue. Would they be allowed to retain, wouldn't that reduce other aspects to reduce their return otherwise?
I have no idea. I don't know. But I do know that any, as the commission said, any potential impact on the FT rate, if somehow this 400,000 is going into that somehow, won't be known until the next FT1 rate case.
So you're saying that
does maybe.
One possibility is it's doing exactly what the reason that the commission issued these new orders was, it's going to monopoly profit.
And it may be. It may be. I mean, the commission didn't come right and say that's what happened, but it said the only evidence in the record of actual effect on the FT1 revenues from the last rate case is the 50,000, and that was established, like I said, in testimony before the ALJ, and the commission didn't revisit that. Of course, it was affirming the ALJ throughout the order.
The commission didn't respond to Williston's metaphor about judging the health of the arm by looking at a fingernail.
Well, it didn't, because if there's nothing in the record before the ALJ that the actual effect on FT.
The only thing in the record before the ALJ relates to the fingernail, inferences about the arm seem weak.
Well, failure to present evidence regarding the arm, I don't know what the commission.
The evidence of what NSP expected to gain. It's hard to see
sure.
why.
Well, and that's why the commission did make a finding, even if. But and it said if that 400,000 is going to affect the FT1 rates, it's not going in the sense that if it's taken away from wherever it's going now, it somehow changes what those rates turn out to be. That won't be known till the next rate case.
That's undoubtedly true.
And
but meanwhile, somebody loses it, right? In other words, it's a wealth shift from
it is.
Somebody to NSP.
But the commission found, based on not only on its own policy, but just the fact that, I mean, this is directly coming back against the money NSP is paying for the capacity, I think, that it was more clearly worth something to NSP, whereas its actual impacts on the FT1 rates was a lot more amorphous, because it depends on the next rate case, depends what happens with other costs of service, depends on all sorts of things that just aren't knowable and that should be addressed in that Section 4 rate case whenever it is filed. I did want to quickly address the point you had mentioned. I believe, Judge Williams, you mentioned this earlier about the mainline costs. And the ALJ and the commission affirming the ALJ said that this record is not clear on what the breakdown of the X13 rate is. So the commission said, we're not going to get into that. Williston remains free under the same Memphis clause to file a Section 4 rate case if it thinks that the X13 rate isn't fair. It isn't covering whatever costs. So any determination of whether the mainline costs are somehow included in that, there isn't a record here to do it, and it's not the place to do it. But if they want to file a Section 4 case with regard to the X13 rate, they have that right. And
yeah.
As the commission also pointed out, there's no dispute that Northern States has been receiving this reserved contract demand capacity on the mainline with the receipt points on the mainline for the entire length of the contract. So. The main line's probably in there somewhere, but on this record, the commission didn't need to get into it.
Could you quickly explain the biennial adjustment?
Sure. As I understand it, in odd-numbered years, after whenever the when the contract was signed in 91, so I guess 93, 95, et cetera, I believe Williston Basin makes a Section 4 filing to adjust the rate. And what they do is they take, and I hope I get
this
right.
They make a Section 4 filing to go to take the rate down?
To adjust it. It may go down some years.
I
it
see,
may not.
But they're obligated to make the Section 4 filing? Is that it?
I believe it has to be done, and
no,
I believe
it
is done
it
through.
Unless it took the rate up, right?
Well, they're required to do the review. I think it's through a Section 4 filing, but the review has to happen. And it takes certain cost of service elements and figures from whatever the most recent FT1 rate mm-hmm. case was.
And this is the mechanism by which the rates are intended to converge.
I believe, so. Actually, I'm not entirely clear on how that part of it happens. That may have something to do with the increment. I'm not entirely clear on that. I do know that it uses cost of service numbers from the FT1 rate case. Previously, the commission had ordered that 25 basis points would be knocked off the return on equity figure. NSP gave that back, and the commission approved giving that back, so now the return on equity figure will be the same in both proceedings. So I don't know if I know the details of that.
Yeah.
Anything further?
Can I just ask one quick? I was asking before about this difference because they're paying the FT1 rates. In the reply brief, they say this is a very small amount, and the 25 basis point difference is only like $8,000 a year. Is that correct?
Council was pointing.
I think that may be right, and the commission didn't lean heavily on this being a huge monetary factor.
You're not leaning on it either, that heavily. So you're not leaning.
No, just that the commission did emphasize that the X13 rate, the full incremental rate, covers the cost recovery on the Mapleton extension and remains higher than FT1. And yeah, they made that concession, but the commission didn't say, you know, this is huge. It totally equals the commission didn't do anything like that. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to talk for 1 minute about how the restatement works. There's a formula rate. The cost of service is set out by category for the cost of the Mapleton extension, and every 2 years we have to file to reflect whatever those actual costs were for the preceding calendar year. And in most of the biennial restatements, the rate has gone down, and it goes down under Section 4. There was one occasion where the rate went up, but that was due to fuel. And the only reason why it's still an incremental rate is that we asked for 20-year depreciation to go with the 20-year contract, and the commission said, no, you have to depreciate over 45 years. So that's the reason why the rate has gone down more slowly than you would have expected and why it hasn't converged in the way that it would have.
This is a hypothetical question, but still
yes.
Of interest. Suppose we were to reverse, would not and could not the commission fairly easily write an opinion of the sort sketched out by Judge Garland and produce an outcome that would be invulnerable to appeal?
The commission has learned over the years how to write these kinds of orders when it wants to, but it didn't do it here. And I think in order to do it in this case, they have to show that the public interest requires that this be changed and that they have to show that there's an impact on NSP, that a severe financial hardship to NSP to be stuck with the bargain it made.
That's if we take the public interest test as the test, right?
Yeah,
that's
suppose
not.
Suppose you lose on the Memphis Clause.
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Suppose you lose on the Memphis Clause issue.
And so
public interest and extreme hardship are out of the case, right?
There still has to be just and reasonable, and there has to be substantial evidence of record.
Aren't the sort of competitive values which underlay 636 and so forth applicable.
Yes.
Applicable more strongly than then.
Yes, but I do think that the commission has an obligation to explain why this is the only contract that requires this. And it's not because our affiliate, which is a local distribution company regulated by four state commissions, is a customer of our system. The, every dollar the utility pays or receives from Williston Basin goes back to the ratepayers. Nothing goes to the stockholders.
Well, couldn't, I mean, just to follow up on this hypothetical, couldn't they say, whether this is the only contract or not, this is our policy going forward and starting in this case?
They could accept that they have a higher standard for changing a contract than they have for making a rulemaking or any of those other kind of things, and they can't just say, we changed our policy because of you, without evidence that supports why they're doing it. And it can't be because we prefer it.
Under Bell Aerospace, I think you're wrong. Anything they can do by rulemaking, they can do
by adjudication.
By adjudication.
No, I believe it's the Texaco case that we cite. The court says, wait, can you wait 1 second? It's page 5 of my copy. It's 148 Fed 3rd 1091, and it says, the public interest that permits FERC to modify private contracts is different from and more exacting than the public interest that FERC seeks to serve when it promulgates its rules.
Yeah, but that sounds like an application of a situation where a Memphis clause is absent.
Yes, but it's the principle's the same. You can't just come in and, you know, it's just goes back to the Sierra Pacific case that you know, the commission's not supposed to relieve the parties of a bad bargain. You're supposed to stick with what you signed up for.
It goes back to the Memphis case. Right.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.